are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 21st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mark Leon Goldberg of UN Dispatches on why we have so much traffic in New York City, or otherwise known as the development of the Sustainable Development Goals, the next 15 years, what the UN hopes to achieve. Also on the program today, it's unbelievable corporate malfeasance. Volkswagen develops a system to essentially lie on the inspections of its emissions of some of its cars. Meanwhile, new reports out, Exxon has known about global warming for 40 years and have been lying about it. Also, a U.S. commits to upping the number of refugees it will take, but not very many. U.S. military dumbing down ISIS intelligence. We got a clown car report. Pope coming to Congress this week. Podcast trolls not quite dead yet. Seattle's teacher strike over. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, folks. One thing that is just off the top, which is pretty stunning, and I want to talk to Mark Goldberg about it, among the other things. But for the first time ever, and I don't think just in the United States, the United States may actually abstain on the annual vote to criticize the U.S. for its embargo of Cuba. Every year, I don't know for how long, the United Nations General Assembly condemns the U.S. trade embargo with Cuba. Right now, the Obama administration is contemplating abstaining from that vote. In other words, basically not vetoing the condemnation. It is unheard of for a UN member to not oppose resolutions that are critical of its own laws. However, Congress refuses to lift the embargo, and the Obama administration is willing to say, like, okay, well, justify it to the UN. It's fascinating. We will talk to Mark Leon Goldberg about that in a moment. But first, folks, Pats nailed the Bills. That was pretty obvious. I saw that coming a mile away. Sorry about that. Took advantage of it on FanDuel. You've seen the ads. Your friends are playing. Now it's your turn to get signed up at FanDuel.com. It's the trusted leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and payouts than any other site. They're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. Building a team is easy. Just pick your players, stay under the salary cap, sit back on Sunday, watch your team win. Entry fees start at just $1. Anyone can play. Last year, some dude named Matt Nichols from Ohio, folks, turned a $25 deposit into over $25,000 playing fantasy football on FanDuel. Join him and over the 1 million other users who have already won money on FanDuel. Go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use my code MAJOR, as in majority, MAJOR, and sign up now. Special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offers only good for the first 50 people that use my code MAJOR today. Don't forget to use the code MAJOR. FanDuel.com. Every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up today. And folks, it's not just about football around here. Michael allows me to watch the football, and then Michael sits back with a glass of Chablis. And turns on. Michael's waiting with bated breath. And I actually, Nikki has been, we've been trolling around for a show to watch. This could be it. Indian Summers. In 1932, the height of privilege was to be British in India. And the high point was the summer season at the hard-partying colonial retreat of Simla in the Himalayan foothills. Michael is having a heart attack. Michael is giddy at the notion of watching this show. It is, I mean, the idea of like, you know, you get a look at sort of the colonists, the Brits, partying in India. A rich cast representing British and Indian interests alternately clash and conspire in intricate games of power, politics, and passion. Julie Walters and a cast of Indian, British, and Pakistani actors star in this visually rich 9-part epic set in India during the twilight of British rule. The sweeping new series premieres Sunday, September 27th. That's in a week. A 9 p.m. Eastern on Masterpiece on PBS. Masterpiece series back. It's a 9-part series, premieres Sunday, like I say, set in India in 1932. It's the twilight of the British Raj. Michael, why don't you tell everybody what Raj means? You don't know? It's the British rule. Which ended in 1947.
British rule of India.
What would, I don't know if we should go into a
yes, what would
right-wing
like
Gandhi for this.
Like, if they leave, we won't have, there's no discipline.
Right.
That will ruin the economy. Indians don't think, and I know I'm politically incorrect to say that, but we don't have time for political correct.
Go to majority.fm. We have got a 2-minute introductory video up there. Check it out. I can't wait for the story where we have a Republican congressman who redoes his entire office in an Indian Summers theme.
All the jobs are leaving now.
All right.
I will fast into Britain's days.
Check it out. It looks pretty good, though, I got to say. It does, from the 2-minute video, it looks pretty good. We'll be right back with Mark Leon Goldberg. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Mark Goldberg. He is the editor of UN Dispatches and also the host of GlobalDispatchesPodcast.com. And it's a show, folks, that I think you would actually really enjoy. Folks like everyone from George Mitchell to Jeffrey Sachs, Fareed Zakaria, and Nicholas Kristof. A Mark Maron show for international relations, if you will. But Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. That's the gist of it, I think.
But now you don't spend like the first 15 minutes talking about how you're upset with your cats, right?
No, typically not.
All right. Well, that's good. Folks skip over that part anyways on WTF. I don't think I'm telling think secrets so. out of town. All right. Well, so let's talk about this because this happens annually, I guess, in New York, where you have a General Assembly meeting of at the UN. But this year is sort of fundamentally different. I was never even aware that the UN set its agenda in 15-year increments. Is that the case?
Well, so that's been the case for the International Development Agenda, the anti-poverty global health agenda of the UN since 2000. The advent of the Millennium Development Goals in 2000 set 8 international development targets to be achieved by the end of 2015. With the end of 2015 coming upon us, the UN and the international community has come together to set another set of international goals, this time called the Sustainable Development Goals, which will drive the international development agenda from 2015 to 2030.
And so how did they do, I mean, obviously, and I don't know if this was part of that story, but I learned from your site of the extraordinary success in terms of malaria, which may not necessarily be part of that, but give us a sense of what
I mean, malaria is a good example. So in the year 2000, you had millions of malaria deaths annually. And this is an easily preventable disease that's transmitted by mosquito. Really simple interventions like sleeping under a bed net reduces the chance of transmission and of death dramatically. Most people killed by this disease are children under 5. And most people, most children under 5 that are killed by this disease are in sub-Saharan Africa. So in 2000, it was a big year. It was the millennium. The Pope at the time, and also George Bush to his credit and Bill Clinton to precede him, decided to come together around a set of international development goals to just reduce the burden of poverty and these horrible diseases. One of the goals they set was to reduce malaria deaths by half in 15 years' time. And that goal was achieved this year. Malaria deaths have been reduced by 60% as of this year, contributing to the saving of something like 6 million kids' lives. So that's just one example of this process by which governments and this time around civil society and the public have coalesced around a set of goals to be achieved in 15 years' time. Now, the big headline of this coming summit, which kicks off Friday in New York with the Pope's speech, is that the international community is pledging to totally eradicate global extreme poverty by 2030. And extreme poverty is defined by people who live on less than $1.25 a day. So that's the big headline, I think, going into this UNGA session.
Based upon other agenda points for the Millennium Development Goals, how did the UN fare? And before we actually get to that, because, you know, the malaria thing sticks out in my mind because I remember speaking, I think it was to Naomi Klein when she had gotten back from Davos, I believe it was, in 2004 maybe or 2005. And I remember that Sharon Stone had gotten up at one of these meetings and had basically almost hijacked it for the sake of these nets. And there was a sense as she was trying to get commitments from people there to put, I don't know, 10 million, 5 million into buying these nets, that in some ways there was a concern that this was letting off these billionaires easy because, you know, okay, you spend a couple of $1 million on nets, you do, and it turns out, obviously, you save literally millions of lives, but you're not necessarily helping with the infrastructure that would have a longer-term impact, right? Because, I mean, malaria, this is just preventive. It's not necessarily stopping the sources of malaria, right?
Well, to a degree. I mean, if you can get malaria transmission rates low, malaria is considered eradicated from the country. So you can, if you can stop the transmission, you can eradicate malaria. But your point about strengthening health systems, I think, is very important, very clear. Back in 2000, this is 15 years ago, the emphasis was on specific diseases, like reducing the burden of AIDS, TB, tuberculosis, and malaria specifically. This time around, there's a recognition that strengthening entire health systems and health infrastructures is just as important. So you'll see embedded in the new sustainable development goals, pledges and commitments to train a health workforce, to strengthen hospital systems, and what they call health extension workers, which are basically trained nurses who go out to rural communities and villages and advise and provide health care on in really the hardest to reach places. So those kinds of interventions that are premised on building up health systems and strengthening health infrastructure is what the sort of like the next horizon of global health interventions. And you see the NGO community in particular rallying around this idea as well.
And so there, what, there are 17, you said there were 17 goals and, and close to 170 targets.
And the top goal is the total eradication of extreme poverty. What distinguishes the forthcoming sustainable development goals from the Millennium Development Goals are two things. First, back in 2000, there wasn't this recognition, there was a recognition that that economic development and environmental sustainability have to be kept in two separate silos, and that you couldn't really have one without the other. What's remarkable about this forthcoming meeting at the UN is that it's a recognition by every country on the planet that you can't have one without the other. You can't have economic development without environmental sustainability, without sort of dooming us all. So there is this kind of grand bargain embedded throughout these goals that you can't have one without the other. The second distinguishing factor is that these goals are not just binding on poor countries around the world. They're something that are accepted by everyone. So, for example, the top goal of totally eradicating global extreme poverty by 2030, one goal under that, this, like goal 1.2, is to reduce by two-thirds the number of people living in poverty as defined by national definitions of poverty. So in theory, the U.S. is pledging to reduce its own poverty rate by substantially by 2030 by signing on to this agenda.
So, okay. So I have two questions that come from that. The first is what, to what extent, I mean, if it's the case that there is sort of an integration between this notion of what is healthy for the planet, you know, and I think, I mean, I guess there's an argument that growth and sustainability are not necessarily at odds, but there's certainly a significant amount of tension there. Are there commitments that are inverse in some respects? In other words, when we talk about the growth and the sustainability, are there commitments by industrialized nations to cut emissions? Is that part of that interplay? In other words, are those who don't need growth as much as they need sort of to cap to make things more sustainable? They have skin in the game in that way.
So to an extent, the Sustainable Development Goals punt that issue to the international climate change negotiations, which are coming to a head in November. But the goals do have embedded in them this idea that the developed community has to help transfer technology to the developing world to help them grow in a sustainable fashion. And a good example of this is goals related to energy consumption. The Sustainable Development Goals have within them a specific goal to promote the use of sustainable energy sources, I think by two-thirds in 30 years' time. The idea is that, you know, a country like Niger in the middle of Africa, you know, needs, for example, help setting up solar systems to power its cities and villages. And the international, the wealthier countries are pledging to help them do that by signing on to this set of goals. But the specific degrees to which that's done is going to be negotiated in Paris in the big climate talks that are coming in November and December this year.
And so getting back to the agenda of eradicating extreme poverty, and then I guess the subsidiary goals of eradicating mm-hmm. two-thirds of poverty in participating nations. Are there like benchmarks, like 7 years out, it mm-hmm. should be here, 8 years out, it should be here, or is it we just show up in 2030 and go, oops, didn't happen?
Well, so those benchmarks are going to be decided in a future meeting, I think this coming spring. The purpose of this particular meeting so is to have heads of state formally commit themselves to these goals, and then some of those details are going to be worked out later on. And that's sort of similar to what happened with the Millennium Development Goals. The MDGs, as they are known, had a goal of reducing by half the number of people who live on less than a dollar a day. And that was achieved, largely due to the rapid growth of China and India over the last 10 years. But that specific goal was achieved, I think, in like 2006.
Wow.
So there are going to be these kind of mid-year and midpoint benchmarks for sure.
What impact do these goals have? In other words, mm-hmm. I mean, how do respective governments, and I imagine it's different, like, you know, President Cruz, I would imagine, would come back and see this as sort of some form of tyranny, in that we would have to have an agenda to specifically increase the amount of poverty we have in this country so as not to be told what to do by the UN. But, I mean, give us a sense of how it's received depending on – I would imagine it's country-specific, but are there broad categories?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So the MDG – I mean, we know sort of how they will be received by looking at how the Millennium Development Goals, which were created in 2000, were received. And the MDGs were a much bigger deal in poor countries than they were in wealthier countries. So wealthier countries helped poor countries achieve the goals. But, you know, you have like ministers of health and foreign ministers using the MDGs as benchmarks against which to measure their own national progress on issues related to like maternal mortality or child survival or child nutrition. They would use the MDGs as benchmarks against which to measure their own progress in their own countries, and use the MDGs as a way to rally international support to their country and to their cause. So, I mean, a reduction of child mortality is a good example. You know, you could have a country like Ethiopia, which is a poor country riddled with child deaths and child mortality, making a national commitment to achieve the MDGs, then using that national commitment to secure donors and NGOs to come in and help them achieve that goal. So the process of goal setting was, it turns out in retrospect, very significant, even though these goals are not like legally binding, right? They're just something that countries pledge to do. But it turns out having a very public pledge and having a very public goal-setting process has a pretty important galvanizing effect. So I think what the UN is trying to do with these SDGs coming forth is replicating that idea, but the ambitions and the scale of the SDGs, I think, are much grander than the MDGs.
What are the mechanics of that? Because, you know, I would imagine that the if you were to poll, let's say, in the United States, and maybe it's just that the polling is different in a different country, but if you poll people in the United States as to, hey, what are the sustainable development goals of the UN that they're developing this week? I don't know that there's really any word in that sentence that would poll with greater than like 15% awareness. I mean, and in Ethiopia, is it political pressure on anywhere else, is it political pressure on the government because of that? Or is it pressure that is born by that comes from, I don't know, from other countries? I mean, what is the mechanics of the goal having that type of traction in a country like that, that creates that type of political pressure in a country like Ethiopia or anywhere else, where those goals actually seem to impact the governments and the sort of the, I guess, the NGO behavior?
I think principally the prospect of getting a lot of money to invest in your health system is really enticing for many of these developing countries. But what I should say also is different this time around is that these countries, these developing countries, are pledging to put a lot of their own skin in the game and a lot of their own money to the cause. So I think one is it's a money game. Like there is this idea that there is going to be this pool of funds out there which that they can tap into to reduce their own maternal mortality rates, to build solar panels, to improve resiliency in the face of a huge natural disaster, to like build their buildings stronger and earthquake proof. So there is going to be funding available from different sources, not just the wealthy countries, but from the private sector as well. Governments and corporations and nonprofits are all kind of banding together around discrete parts of this agenda to help create coalitions to move the needle in the right direction.
It's interesting. Good.
Yeah. Well, I just add one thing. You were making the point before the call dropped about, you know, how the American public imagines this. And there is, I think, a huge gap between what Americans think that their country is doing and what the country is actually doing. In this case, you know, the USA actually has a lot to be proud of in terms of helping advance the Millennium Development Goals. The PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Release, helped reduce the AIDS burden in Africa in particular significantly. But we were talking about malaria earlier. This entity called the PMI, the President's Malaria Initiative, helped get bed nets to Southern Africa to help us, you know, achieve the Millennium Development Goal on malaria. So the U.S. is actually doing a lot in this space, and it's sort of bipartisan, which is kind of remarkable. There are partisan aspects to it, particularly around maternal mortality and reproductive health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's stuff easily, especially around reproductive health access and access to contraception, which is hugely important. That kind of gets caught up in domestic abortion politics. But other than that, it's a pretty kind of bipartisan endeavor.
I mean, I guess the idea is if they're spending money on other issues, then they can't fund Agenda 21. And
exactly.
All right. Well, let me just ask you one other a couple other questions,
yeah.
Sort of subsidiary, I guess, at least to the Sustainable Development Goals. I imagine that one of the biggest topics that's going to be discussed as world leaders get together is Syria and the refugee crisis, and not necessarily in that order. Give
yeah.
me your sense of how they will be discussed and sort of, are those two separate tracks or is one going to be ignored? I mean, because there seems to be a refugee crisis now.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a refugee crisis for 3.5 years. This is just now we're suddenly having a refugee crisis in Europe.
Right.
So it's suddenly on top of the political agenda. But keep in mind, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan are hosting by far the vast majority of Syrian refugees. There's something like 4.5 million Syrian refugees, only something like 300,000 of which have made it to Europe. The rest are in those other countries, are in Turkey, Jordan, and Syria. To answer your question directly, though, yes, I think these two issues, the conflict in Syria and the Syrian refugee crisis, are going to be disaggregated at the coming UN General Assembly, which is, I think, out of necessity a bit, because the UN is so, so desperate to raise funds to provide for basic humanitarian assistance for Syrian refugees. The appeals, basically the way that these refugees in the surrounding countries are cared for is that the UN says we need, in this case, about $4 billion to care for all these refugees. And they ask donors to pitch in the money. But donors at this point are giving less than half of what the UN says is required to care for the very basic humanitarian needs of these refugee communities. And that's being manifest by the refugees by things like having their food rations cut. So, for example, the World Food Program in Lebanon had to cut the calories that they can give to recipients by half because they had no money. They're running out of money. And so the UN, and Ban Ki-moon in particular, is going to use the coming General Assembly to try to rally the cause and try to raise funds for the humanitarian appeal. The political leaders are going to keep bickering over what to do about the actual political crisis in Syria. But this year, it's a little more interesting just for the fact that Vladimir Putin is going to be in town. And he has his own agenda about what to do with Syria that's not necessarily the same as Obama's. So, you know, we'll see, I think, a lot of interesting, you know, political intrigue on that. But this basic question of how to improve the condition of these 4 million refugees, I don't think, sadly, is going to be resolved with this coming UN meeting.
Well, let us disaggregate it too. Is when we're talking about the refugees, and you're talking about, you know, 4 million some odd between Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Maybe it's less, but
Turkey.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but I would imagine, right, that the pitch to help these people is that this could be incredibly destabilizing for those countries. Is that right? I mean, I would imagine, you know, to have an influx of that many refugees, tell me if you know, like, where is it most destabilizing? And then who is either most sensitive to the destabilization of those countries, and who is maybe saying, I wouldn't mind it if it was so destabilized?
Well, the country that is most at the brink is probably Lebanon, where right now one in every five people in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee. That's the scale of the crisis. Wow. Lebanon is a country that's experienced horrible civil war, a 20-year civil war from the 70s to the 90s. Right now has a very tenuous and very unstable political system that's based largely on ethnic breakdowns within Lebanon. There's this old kind of saying back in like the international relations circles that when Syria gets sneezes, Lebanon gets a cold. You've seen some examples of reprisal and of violence and of political violence happening in Lebanon. But so far, it's held, but the country is still very much a tinderbox and obviously in a very volatile region. So Lebanon's very concerning. Jordan is also very concerning. I mean, here you have a U.S. ally that is stable, though under the surface perhaps not so. It's also a very environmentally depleted country. There's just not a lot of water and environmental resources to sustain an influx of a massive influx of people in Jordan. And there's concern that, you know, that country, and I've heard the head of the UN Refugee Agency make this point in a meeting in Washington, D.C. I mean, here you have this key U.S. ally, Jordan, that's not very stable, that has all these environmental stresses, that has now millions of people coming into their country that they just can't ask, that they can't handle. So how come you're not just giving us money to help feed them in these camps? And like, what, how come you're not looking for any durable solution to the refugee crisis? But Turkey is a little more of a stable country, and Turkey, you know, despite its other issues, has actually been doing a pretty admirable job of caring for what they call guests in their country.
So, I mean, but from the perspective of like, where are the Saudis on this? Where are the Israelis? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, do the Saudis have something to fear by a destabilized Jordan? Do the Israelis perceive a further destabilized Lebanon as a problem, or as perhaps, you know, something like, okay, Hezbollah will be busy dealing with this other thing and we don't have to worry about them? I mean, what are the different currents there?
Well, with Israel, their main sort of security concern and their security issue has been manifest along the Golan Heights, where you've actually seen, because of violence, a reduction in the UN peacekeeping troops that have patrolled that that strip between Israel and Syria because of the presence of al-Qaeda, the al-Nusra Front, for a long time held control of that territory. So now Israel suddenly, you know, where they had this kind of modus vivendi with the Assad regime around the Golan issue. Clearly, they weren't allies, but they weren't in a hot conflict. I think it's terribly concerning for Israel to have such instability right across their border. For Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia is one of the, I think, combatants, though not declared so, in this conflict in Syria. I mean, Syria is, to a large degree, a proxy war between a number of different actors, and Saudi Arabia is one of them. And they have not permitted any refugees from resettling in their country. Other Gulf countries, like Kuwait in particular, are out front helping to fund the humanitarian response that I was referring to before. Kuwait has played host to pledging conferences to help fund the humanitarian relief. So they're doing slightly better, and the other Gulf countries are doing slightly better on that scale, but no country in the region other than Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon have opened up their borders to massive flows of refugees. Mm.
So, okay, so lastly, sum it up for us. What should we be looking for over the next week and a half? I mean, is there something in particular that folks like that UN watchers like yourself are seeing as sort of the benchmark as to the success of this, or is that even the wrong way to look at it?
The success of the SDGs, the fact of the SDG summit is a success itself. These goals were negotiated for over 2 years. So that we're even having this summit, in which like the Pope and Barack Obama and many other people are coming to speak, is the culmination of these last 2 years of backroom diplomacy that are now coming to fruition in a very public way. And that SDG summit then turns it over to governments and civil society to implement these goals. Behind the scenes, there's one interesting nugget. It's a little inside baseball. The president is hosting for the first time ever this UN peacekeeping pledging conference at the UN, where the background is that UN peacekeeping is coming under a lot of stress. There have never been so many missions, so many troops deployed to so many places that are so complicated. The U.S. doesn't contribute very many troops, but it pays for 27% of the cost of all missions. And so the U.S. government, and Barack Obama, to his credit, wants very much for these missions to be more successful. So he is holding this pledging conference where countries can help contribute assets like helicopters or troops or body armor, things like that. Very tangible results may come out of this UN peacekeeping meeting. Again, a little inside baseball, but it's important for the UN system, and it's something that UN watchers in particular are going to be paying close attention to.
Interesting stuff. Mark Goldberg, the show is globaldispatchespodcast.com. We'll put a link at majority.fm and also to Global Dispatch, the site itself. Thanks so much for your time today, Mark.
All
really
right.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Bye-bye.
My pleasure.
So there you have it, folks. And, I forgot to ask him, but the UN's been like having some weird light show on the side of the building. I don't know if they're projecting something on there or what. But interesting. It'll also be interesting this week to see what happens when the Pope speaks to the Republicans on Thursday, where I'll be speaking to the entire Congress. But it's going to be interesting to see how the Republicans react, because they're apparently a little nervous. Because apparently the Pope is a leftist. We did that story last week, right, Matt?
Yeah.
Where the Republican says, I refuse to – I'm a Catholic, but I refuse to go because Pope shouldn't –
Screw that guy. I don't know who he is.
Oh, who does he think he is?
He's my infallible spiritual and religious leader on all relevant matters. But if he starts talking about politics and economics, then I swear I'll smack the cap off of his friggin' face.
You missed it. Myla asked me the other day. She said we were walking to swim class, and she said, who's this guy who wears a yarmulke that everybody's talking about?
She doesn't know who the Pope is?
That's awesome.
She does now.
There,
really, you guys
that,
never discussed.
You have done
the,
such
the
a
Pope
you have done a
up.
Fantastic
as I was
job
no,
of Jewish
I just,
parenting
she,
right
this,
there.
She did not realize that everyone wasn't Jewish.
And then what you need to do is you need to do the Yid callback there. And you,
I mean,
you
it's
say,
totally that's he, totally a possibility in New York City. I
said
mean,
that's not a yarmulke.
You do the Yid callback. You say he's a nice man.
He's a
and
nice
he said
man.
Nothing
he's just
new.
A little bit confused.
See, he thinks the Messiah came a long time ago.
Yes, he's. Jesus. He the only thing they ever did was to give us a good opportunity to get a foothold in banking by saying that lending was illegal for the Catholics. And so someone had to provide the loans.
When are we going to start taking My Little Mosque?
And thus your great Uncle Dave would loan money to people.
At a certain fee, or
well, of course,
or,
I mean,
or vig.
Everyone needs to get a little taste. I mean,
are you familiar with the phrase "wet my beak," Myla? It's very important.
It's very important. I mean, it's what makes the world go round. I just thought it was pretty funny that she thought the Pope was wearing a yarmulke.
When I was a kid, I think that might have been one of my first thoughts about
the Pope.
I'm
not even clear on what the Pope is wearing.
He's a friggin' ripped off yarmulke. We just said it. Myla nailed it.
Boom.
Stop stealing our stuff.
God. Take.
I want to take a derakappas. Sorry.
We're going to take a quick break, speaking of which. And this story of Volkswagen just, it's jaw-dropping.
It's disruptive.
It is.
Innovative.
It's so innovative. It is jaw-dropping. But it also, I mean, all of it. I mean, it hits every base. Just some house cleaning. Wednesday, I will be off for Yom Kippur. We will have a Matt and Michael Wednesday, unless you guys are going to, no, right? You know.
No, we'll do it.
And, oh, you're going to go to temple in the evening? Are you really?
I think so. I might actually.
In the evening, Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they won't be having services. No, you got to do it before sundown. Then the people go to the breakfast.
Oh, I'm totally out of the loop.
Well, I guess
I know nothing.
Yeah, really out of the loop, buddy. You're thinking of cold Nidra on Tuesday night.
I'll go to a break.
All right. Going to take a quick break. And, one more thing I want to mention. I briefly alluded to this last week, and it does look like on Wednesday we are going to launch the first of what I hope will be multiple new podcasts. This is basically, you know, we've upgraded our video. We're getting in the new computer to handle the multi-camera. You've seen some hints of it on the debates. We're going to be working on the set, but we've been developing other podcasts, and we hope to roll out more over the next couple of months. And part of it is, the theory behind this is that we have a business model on the Majority Report that is a function of our topic. Politics, you're just not going to get that big. You're just not going to get that huge to drive the advertising revenue that, you know, a comedy podcast, let's say, does. We're rolling out the first one this week. It is called Sportocracy. We will have a link to it on majority.fm later this week. And what I'm going to ask of you guys, and I promise you, I'm only going to ask this no more than a half a dozen times over the next 6 to 8 months. No more than a half a dozen times. I'm going to want you to subscribe and download the first couple of episodes. And what that's going to do is that's going to push us up into hopefully the what's hot and what's new. And then the podcast has to survive on its own. I think a lot of people listening to this program are going to enjoy it. Brian Rich is a very smart guy. You met Grant briefly during the debate. Also a smart guy. And the show is really interesting, and it deals with all the different sort of elements of sports and how it intersects with society in a multitude of ways. It's not necessarily political, but, you know, there's obviously a disposition that that I think we share to a certain extent. So I think for a lot of you, you're really going to enjoy it. But even if you are just appalled by the notion of sports, or appalled of the notion of society, or appalled of the notion of audio, or whatever it is that you find appalling, I'm going to ask you to subscribe and do this. And it is basically, this is, you know, this is why people contributed to the Indiegogo campaign. And I am determined to spend all of that money on trying to develop other mechanisms which will help long-term the revenue for this program. That's the whole theory here, is that we can build other properties that will help fund this show. So we'll send an email blast also on Wednesday or Thursday morning reminding you. We will these guys will remind you on Wednesday when we release it. We'll put a link at majority.fm, all of that. But it's really important it happens over the course of the next 3 or 4 days, you know, the 2 or 3 days after we launch. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Take your phone call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Don't forget Just Coffee, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Want to become a member of the show? Support the show. Get that extra 50 minutes plus a day. Join themajorityreport.com. Want to leave us a review at majority.fm/review on iTunes. That helps. The free app actually cuts into our ranking on iTunes, I think, because we bypass iTunes. So it doesn't see how many people are downloading. Good job, Sam. We'll be right back after this.